Well, the best way to express it is what he said early on in the thing. He said, well, the convention is all sewed up. It's going to be LBJ, and that's it. I mean, you walked into a pen, and you couldn't get out. It was a feeling of brutality. That's before there was any demonstration in the streets and before there was any real trouble. It was clear that the government was frightened. It's as close as I've ever gotten to the Berlin Wall in the United States.
So I thought, why not? Why don't I do this film? Why don't I go underground and show the FBI how it's done?
And you had to find him, of course.
It wasn't hard. Not for me. I mean, it was hard for Jed, for the FBI, but not for me. And Martin Sheen heard about it, and I knew him anyway, but he said, Dee, I want to be in the film. I'll play any part you want me to play. And I said, well, Martin, I'd like you to be the judge. He's the bad guy. And he said, oh, I'd love to do that. I'll be the judge. So Martin's the judge. But not only was the judge, he said, it must cost a lot of money to make that film. I said, well, that's my problem. It does. He said, well, let me give you some. So instead of paying him to act in the film, he sent me a check for $10,000.
The third in our four-part series on America's foremost maker of documentaries, Emile D'Antonio. Right now, on Alternative Views. Past two programs with Emile D'Antonio featured highlights from his documentaries Point of Order, Rush to Judgment, Millhouse, A White Comedy, and Vietnam Year of the Pig. In this third in our four-part series, we'll spotlight three more documentaries.
Dee, after Millhouse, what was your next film project, and what were you feeling about film at that time, having all these films suppressed? Wasn't it discouraging?
I made a film whose title came from Robert Frost, called America's Hard to See. And that was about the Chicago, basically about the 1968 Chicago convention and the fix and the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. And it ends with a great speech, I can say it because it's not my speech, by Arthur Miller, who says something to the effect that what we learned in 1968 is that the people don't own anything. The politicians do, and the people who own the politicians, they own the Democratic National Convention, they own who's going to be elected, who's going to be nominated, and all the rest of it. That was a film made in anger and made very quickly. And then I went on to make, then I went on to finish Painter's Painting, which I had begun.
This war is not just about South Vietnam and North Vietnam. It's about the monolithic power of Communist China and its intention, declared intention, to spread over the balance of free Asia. In my belief, if Communist China is not stopped now in its support of conquest by revolution, Communist China, it may not be possible to take the risk of stopping them later.
Our hearts cry out at the misery and the loss of life in Vietnam, and to the families that have had to share so much and bear so much. Any complaint that they make is understandable. But some who complain the most have sacrificed the least. And some who seem to know the most have been there not at all.
I don't know when I decided to run. I decided, I think, that someone had to challenge the president. Probably when Katzenbach appeared before the Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate and explained what we assumed was the Johnson interpretation of the role of the president in foreign policy.
Mr. Katzenbach said at one point that the Tonkin Gulf resolution was the what he called the functional equivalent of a declaration of war.
But didn't that resolution authorize the president to use the armed forces of the United States in whatever way was necessary? Didn't it?
Well, this
what
is...
could a declaration of war have done?
This
that
is
would
what...
have that would have given the president more authority and a clearer voice of the Congress of the United States than that did.
Senator McCarthy rose from his seat and left the hearing room. I asked him what he thought of the Attorney General's testimony and the position that he was taking on the war-making powers of the president and the role of the Congress, and particularly on a functional equivalent of declaration of war, and he said that he thought this was the silliest testimony he had ever sat through. And he then added, I think this whole issue has got to be taken to the people.
I conclude that if this was really the judgment of the president, that in a way that the engagement in Vietnam was secondary, and that more important than that was really the conception of the role of the presidency in the field of foreign policy, in a way that one was challenging not a particular commitment of the country by a president, but rather challenging his basic understanding as to what his power and what his responsibility and what his role was. I didn't decide then that I should run. I think I decided that there had to be some kind of effective and significant and really kind of a showdown challenge to that point of view.
Last 2 days of the campaign, we took every advertisement off the air except one, which was on the air every 30 minutes, every radio station in the state where everybody drives to work. Some states' radio is better than others. I mean, it was pretty good. And all it said, it didn't mention the war or inflation. It just said, think how you will feel if you wake up Wednesday morning to find that Gene McCarthy has won the New Hampshire primary and New Hampshire has changed the face of American politics.
Dover, McCarthy 47, Johnson 44, others 8.
Why did you do
fantastic?
Concord, McCarthy 205, Johnson 197.
I think he can. I really do. I was a little wary until tonight, but Jesus, he's over 40%. And I think Johnson was claiming maybe 20, and he's got 40%, and just now 43%, and it's climbing. It might go over 50.
Well, as a young volunteer worker, what do you think has made the difference here?
Well, I think part of the thing was the turn for the worse in the war and the Tet invasions. But I think the most important thing was the student participation in it.
And this, I think, very clearly shows as we go on from here to Wisconsin and on to the other states of the Union in which we have primaries and carry the fight into the states that do not have primaries. We raise the issue of the war and we raise the issue of priorities at home, and also the very basic one that we have been dealing with in the last 4 or 5 days, that of the need for some real leadership and sense of purpose in America.
You know, the New Hampshire primaries are unique in politics. They're the only races where anybody can run. And everybody can win. I think New Hampshire is the only place where candidates can claim 20% is a landslide and 40% is a mandate and 60% is unanimous.
Last night, President Johnson kind of discounted the New Hampshire primary, saying anybody can enter and everybody can win. Do you go along with that?
Well, he said everybody can run and everybody can win, I think was what he said. But the next line is from Alice in Wonderland, which is that not everybody deserves the prize, however.
We're going to win. I mean, that's the essential point. It suddenly occurred to me 3 days ago.
that we had won in New Hampshire. You know, we really had. And we had all the delegates out of Massachusetts. And we had won in Minnesota with minimal organization after the president and the vice president put great organization into Minnesota. And it suddenly occurred to me that something is really happening in America and that Lyndon Johnson is not going to be renominated for president. We are going to defeat an incumbent president of the United States. We're going to change presidents.
We are no longer simply raising an issue for the American people to pass upon. We are no longer conducting a kind of educational program with reference to Vietnam and other national problems. No longer conducting a kind of children's crusade to get them away from demonstrations and protests, to keep them busy until they accept the establishment in middle age. But in fact, I as your candidate and you as my supporters, we are seeking the presidency of the United States of America.
If enough people who sense the apathy and that they can't do anything and so forth, it gives you a sense, yes, you can be felt. You can be heard. It was a whisper up in New Hampshire, and it's becoming a roar in Wisconsin.
I've noticed a kind of new escalation on the part of the Johnson administration. In New Hampshire, they used the governor and one senator against me. Here in Wisconsin, partly because they're short governors and senators, I suppose, who might support them or present their cause, but I understand they're sending in two cabinet members. It's a new policy they have. They never let one go out alone. In the earlier days of Russian communism, it was said they never let one travel alone. And it used to be the practice before the religious orders were more or less modernized that there were always two nuns together. They've given up on that in the convents now, but evidently the administration has picked this up. They've picked up a lot of things that the church has tried to give up. I was thinking of the Vatican Council, where they begin to raise some questions about grace office and infallibility. These have all been... all been more or less picked up by the administration. The question of heresy and holy war was questioned at the council, but we have them proposed to us now by the Defense Department and State Department. I'd said that the real point of warning would be when they started to talk Latin in the Pentagon. The fact is that they now are. I'm sorry to say that we had a report about 3 weeks ago publicized that the Defense Department, I think it was the Army, had entered into a contract with Douglas Aircraft to do a general research on the subject of Pax Americana. Well, this is the first warning. I expect their next releases from the Pentagon will be pure Latin. And at that point, they won't be any more difficult to understand than some that have been coming out in impure English.
Oh, I think he was operating within the system. I don't see any ideological departure from McCarthy. I think, objectively speaking, anybody who opposed the war in Vietnam was, in a sense, like Roosevelt. Roosevelt had to do what he did in order to preserve the capitalist system in the United States. I think McCarthy, I don't know what his private views are on the subject, but he was acting with perfect consistency like a man who was trying to prevent this country from being ripped to pieces.
From WCBS-TV News in color, The Lake Report with Tom Dunn, Jack Whitaker with the sports, and Gordon Barnes with the weather. Here is Tom Dunn.
Good evening. With the life of Senator Robert Kennedy still hanging in delicate balance tonight, President Johnson addressed the nation to express his shock and dismay. What inspired the attack on Senator Kennedy is not known, he said, but it is known, he added, that he has been senselessly and horribly still.
of course, we learned, at least I did, what Lincoln Steffens had tried to teach people back in the end of the 20s in his books. But it's always a shock and a surprise. I learned that the professionals run the political life of the country. They are professionals just as lawyers are, doctors, any other priesthood, so to speak. They don't want amateurs, laymen, and other ignoramuses to get mixed up in this thing, excepting enough so that it looks like the people are involved in it. Bailey is a good example. He's the head of the was the head of the Democratic Party nationally and in the state. I think Steffens was right, and it was quite obvious. He isn't a bad guy as guys go, I suppose. He's a professional, and that means that, well, the best way to express it is what he said early on in the thing. He said, well, the convention is all sewed up. It's going to be LBJ, and that's it.
Mr. Mayor, there have been statements and charges that you are going to dictate the choice of the Illinois delegation.
Totally erroneous, imaginative, and surely not based with any evidence. It's the usual thing of television, press, radio. The figments of their imagination get the best of them, and they have to ask questions such as yours in order to arouse the emotions of the people. There's no dictation in the Democratic Party. There's never been any dictation. I've been the chairman of two conventions, one in 19 caucuses, in 60 and 64, and the men that are in this room know that every delegate was permitted to get up in the caucus, speak the way he wanted, and vote the way he wanted.
Chicago. We came in by buses, the delegates in enormous convoys, and the buses, as we turned into the stockyard, there was a huge sign that said, sheep and cattle to the right, hogs and goats to the left, and of course we followed the sheep and cattle.
As soon as I arrived, I knew what it was like to be a cow in Chicago. I mean, you walked into a pen, and you couldn't get out. It was a feeling of brutality. That's before there was any demonstration in the streets and before there was any real trouble. It was clear that the government was frightened. It's as close as I've ever gotten to the Berlin Wall in the United States. They were trying to keep the people or something coming emanating from the United States out of this area. It was the professional fencing himself in so they could carry on this game. They were all being led like sheep to the slaughter in their own private opinion. The brutality of it all is what struck me powerfully. And there was an overriding sense that no human voice could be raised against this successfully. It is a show. It's a piece of theater. It's rehearsed in advance, and it takes place on time. There is no place in the convention system for a real discussion of anything.
You did a film on the Weather Underground, which was really unique. Can you tell us about that? Well, it was unique, but most of the people in the Weather Underground, one of the sad things you find if you've lived among radicals, as I have, and I'm a radical, is they don't come from the lower class. You would think that the lower class, which is treated punitively, would be the class that would... But in our society, for instance, the Weather Underground, who made the strongest protest as the Vietnam War started to wind down, were essentially from the upper classes or the middle classes. And these people did a tremendous number of bombings in which they tried never to hurt anybody. But they put a bomb in the State Department. They bombed police stations. They bombed my brother-in-law, who was a CIA person. Gracious. And they bombed his office. They bombed all kinds of people who were, or not people, they didn't bomb people, they bombed all kinds of installations which stood for military power, which stood for the war in Vietnam, which stood for injustice. And the FBI went crazy because they couldn't find these people. The FBI had hundreds of people full-time looking for these guys and women. There were as many women, it was already a feminist group, there were as many women in it as men. And so I thought, why not? Why don't I do this film? Why don't I go underground and show the FBI how it's done? And you had to find them, of course. It wasn't hard. Not for me. I mean, it was hard for Jed for the FBI, but not for me. I just took a friend of mine aside and said, listen, you know where those people are. put me in touch with him. So it began like a mystery story. It was wonderful because he said, about a week later he came by, and he said, okay, go to the Mayflower Hotel. That's 59th Street where Central Park is. And
yes.
He said, go to the third phone booth from the left at exactly 7 o'clock, and the phone will ring. So I went in there, and the phone rang. And a disguised voice said, D'Antonio? I said, yeah. The man said, you will get a message from us, which will tell you what the next step is. So the next step was that I was to go on a subway, which I never take, to be on the last train, to get on the train, then jump off quickly, and then make sure that the train left the station, obviously, and get on the train after that, and take it to a certain station in Brooklyn, hell of a long ride, and there would be a phone booth on the northwest corner, go to the phone booth, and at exactly 7 o'clock, the phone would ring. Phone rang, said, okay, now walk. And I ended up, and I thought the guy who did this had military training, because it's like a great field of fire, you know, except this time it's vision. Because I was standing in a corner, and I was visible from there, and in a huge arc. And I was supposed to stand 5 minutes. I stood 5 minutes, and out of the darkness came this young guy, and he smiled and said, D. And then he gave me his fake name, shook hands. And he said, go over there. There's a woman holding a copy of Time magazine against her chest, like this. And I did. I was so involved, and we went into a restaurant and sat and talked. And they said, now, why do you want to make this film? And da-da-dum-da-dum. And we finally agreed. And then I got Haskell Wexler, and they went to a safe house in California. And we went to the safe house and filmed them and made the film. And the FBI went bananas.
The Days of Rage was an act of political violence. What was your next act?
The next acts were all by the state. I mean, 300 of us were arrested. The conspiracy trial was going on. Bobby Seale was chained and gagged and dragged out of the courtroom. And 3 weeks later, Fred Hampton was murdered and Mark Clark in Chicago.
Bobby Seale is going through all types of physical and mental torture. But that's all right, because we said even before this happened, and we're going to say it after this, and after I'm locked up, and after everybody's locked up, that you can jail revolutionaries, but you can't jail a revolution. Right.
It's 2.5 weeks since Fred Hampton was murdered by the pigs who own this city. It's almost a year since the massacres in Vietnam and the daily massacres that go on against the people of the world have occurred. And we want to announce that we're coming back to the loop, that for people to be able to enjoy Christmas time in this country without remembering and without making a choice about the struggle that's going on in the world, without taking action about a blatant murder that takes place in the city against a revolutionary black leader is an obscenity.
And at that time, we were talking earlier about the corruption and acquiescence of the American people, as well as the revolutionary traditions. And at that point, our political judgment was only to see the corruption, only to see the acquiescence.
Where are you going to march?
Well, we'll march down State Street with the crowd. I mean, we live here in America, see, you know, we're born here in this country, too. And the notion that we're outlaws has got to be put together with the fact that America created us. And we're going to State Street where the rest of the people think they can go and be safe on Christmas Eve day.
If there's no room on the sidewalk, would you go out into the street?
Sure.
I think that we've made plenty of mistakes, and we're not a terrorist organization, and we're not an adventurist organization, and it's irresponsible of people to make that accusation. Of course we make mistakes. Of course partial rebellions don't lead immediately to revolution. And to call those things, to flatten those things out, or to single them out and blow them up and say, this is it, no progress, you lost, you made this mistake, you're irrevocably branded, is to strip revolution of the fact that it's a process.
I say violence is necessary. Violence is a part of America's culture. It is as American as cherry pie. American taught the black people to be violent. We will use that violence to rid ourselves of oppression if necessary. We will be free by any means necessary.
And as a result, we were subpoenaed. Now, the First Amendment of the Constitution is the dearest thing in all law to me. That is that we as Americans have the right to feel, think, write, film anything we want. So I enjoyed testing the First Amendment. We got three great lawyers, and the entire Hollywood community supported us. We stood there with our lawyers, and I read my statement, which said, I believe I have the right to make any film I want. To me, that's as clear an expression as there is of the First Amendment in regard to film. And behind us stood Martin Sheen and Warren Beatty and the head of the Screen Directors Guild and 50 well-known actors and the American Civil Liberties Union, and the FBI withdrew everything. And we won, and we were the first people in the history of film to win. And that year I got the award of the American Civil Liberties Union for defense of the First Amendment. And I'm glad we did it, and it's a good film. And it doesn't advocate bombing, because I make films, not bombs. Those people bombed.
Peace now! Peace now! Peace now! Peace now! Peace now!
We've been organizers and revolutionaries. People, one of the main things that people have asked us is, are upset to us, is that you can't win, it can't work. What can you accomplish? There's nothing we can do. This United States government is so powerful. Just think back 2 months, think back 2 years, think back 5 years. We used to chant, right on, take Saigon, or ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh, the NLF is going to win. Who believed it? Who could believe it? Who had been educated? Who had the tools to believe it? It just happened.
Comrades and friends, what monstrous crimes the U.S. imperialists have committed on our soil. Our entire people, from north to south, close to united, have raised up to defend their freedom and independence. We are absolutely sure of our victory. Since our cause is just, we are strong with our entire people, and with the growing support of the people of the world, including the American people. Long live the friendship between the Vietnamese and the U.S. peoples.
Nó dùng cái chính quy mà nó đối phó lại với cái chiến tranh du kích đó. Thì mà cái chiến tranh du kích là chiến tranh của nhân dân, của toàn dân. Là nó đưa cái chiến thuật nó là trực thăng dẫn. Như thế là nó cơ động rất nhanh để nó đánh lại cái lực lượng của cách mạng. Chúng không ngờ rằng là cái chiến tranh nhân dân thì lại là người ở tại chỗ đánh nó. Cho nên cái cơ động dầu nó nhanh thế nào nó cũng không bằng là cái chiến tranh nhân dân, là nó đến đâu là đụng.
It's over.
Today, America can regain the sense of pride that existed before Vietnam. But it cannot be achieved by refighting a war that is finished, as far as America is concerned.
We are not going to let the war in Vietnam be over.
Everything the U.S. had to throw at Vietnam was thrown. Technology, invasion, limited war, special war, search and destroy, hearts and minds, Vietnamization, everything. Break the will of the people, make the cost too great. And every one of those strategies was understood, and a strategy was developed that let everybody in Vietnam participate in one way or another to defeat that strategy.
Well, I do think that the most important lesson that people can draw from it is that people make history, that history isn't something that happens far away and long ago. History is something that's made by people. It's made by Vietnamese people, and it's made by American people. Tomorrow will only be what the people make it.
This belief in people rather than in technology, we've all been taught to be jaded about, cynical about.
Right.
How could it possibly be, especially here in the middle of a technological wonder, you know?
What you do doesn't make any difference. You don't matter. And I think the revolutionary lesson is just the opposite. What people do makes all the difference. What people do or don't do determines the outcome of things.
Well, the lessons of the war are subversive. I mean, and that's why they have to be covered up immediately. And that's why all the effort goes into reconstructing one false lesson after the other. I mean, a tremendous amount of energy goes into trying to bring back the POWs with a big brass band where there's no jobs for vets and no welcome. If you understand what happened in the Vietnamese War and why the Vietnamese defeated the United States, it makes the possibility and the inevitability of revolution in the United States very clear. The United States government is not invincible. It didn't exist for all time, and it's not going to exist for all time. It's full of weaknesses.
You need this war, they said to the American people. You need this war in order to have enough food, in order to have housing, in order to have the materials that you need to have a good society. This war is going to bring this to you. And I think what people learned is that the war didn't bring those things. Who was it that made profits from the war and who suffered?
Both political parties supported the war in Vietnam. Both political parties support the continuation of a war economy. That the cause of the war wasn't a policy, or it wasn't a bad president, or a bad string of presidents, or even five bad presidents. People were forced over the years to see that it was the whole organization of society, and to call it something that we'd been taught all of our lives was just rhetoric and communist slogans, imperialism, capitalism. That's what it was. That's why we were fighting the war. And what starts to be revealed more and more, with more and more suffering, is that of course it's a class society here. Really no different, subject to the same laws that you see operating in the rest of the world. And that lesson is a very powerful lesson. That lesson is an explosive lesson for the people to grasp and make their own.
Power belongs to the young people, the black people in this country. We're going to remake this country in the streets. Don't get hung up in this fourth party bullshit. Don't get hung up in peace candidates. Come on, we got to fight it out. We're the only power we can build is that's the base. We got to build a strong base, and someday we got to knock those motherfuckers who control this thing right on their ass.
Came out of conditions that were genuine, and the struggle was genuine, the reality was genuine, and had to make the transition from being a student movement and a resistance movement and a protest movement into becoming a revolutionary movement that was broader than students, that took the student base and exploded it into the whole of the American people. That was a change and a transition that demanded a lot of political maturity. And most everybody was not adequate enough to make that transition without a lot of mistakes being made.
We no longer simply resist the pigs. We no longer trap ourselves so that the only possible motion is in response to pig attacks. We have gone on the offensive. It is we who call the shots now.
My film gets treatment that other films don't. When that film, I noticed that the Germans bought it. They bought it for a hell of a lot of money, a tremendous amount of money. this is going to be great. They're going to play it on every station. Instead, they brought it to suppress it. Uh-huh. They brought it on a 7-year contract, and they never played it. And a young German radical who's writing a book about me found out about all this. He wrote a big story that was published in every German newspaper so that we got revenge down to the last bone. Did the FBI step up its activities and surveillance of you after that? Yes. They tried to break into my house. And then, you know, they're always good people. This is a great and complex country. Two young lawyers in the Justice Department wrote me letters, wrote a letter, saying we're resigning from the Justice Department because of what it does to people. And you were among the people. And they said the FBI tried to break into your house.
Wow.
The FBI did this and this and this, and these are the people who were involved, and here are the documents. Oh, my God. So it was pretty great stuff. And I never went public with that because I didn't want to hurt them, in spite of the fact they said they didn't care. But and you notice I haven't mentioned their names, which I remember very well. But
Was this the time where you got your Freedom of Information Act information on the extent of FBI surveillance of you? When did that come about?
Then. And, you know, that film alone generated 10,000 documents. I mean, it's not just 10,000 my whole life. That one film generated 10,000 documents because, as I say, in Mr. Hoover and I, an ex-FBI man came to see me and he said, you know why? You don't even have the numbers for your files on the Weather Underground film? I said, no. He said, because you're listed under Bernadine Dorn. You see, because she was one of the leading Weather Underground people. So what they would do is they would put my file under her file. So when I say, do you have a file on me concerning my Weather Underground film? They could say no. Oh.
This isn't much freedom or much information in this sort of...
No, that's the whole point. It was very, very funny. I mean, you know, you wanted to go and shoot them, but at the same time, you had to realize it was funny. I mean, you know, these people are supposed to represent law and order, and they stand for suppression and disorder. The charter of the FBI is a reasonable charter. The charter of the FBI is to go after criminals. Is to prevent crime across state lines, like bootleggers, bank robbers, etc. But it's not in the Constitution to be used to keep people from making films or writing books or having ideas.
Snobber from New York, and I have a Vietnamese campaign ribbon, Vietnamese service ribbon, National Defense ribbon, and a Purple Heart.
My name is Peter Brannigan, and I got a Purple Heart here, and I hope I get another one fighting these motherfuckers.
New York, I symbolically return all Vietnam medals and all the service medals given me by the power structure that has genocidal policies against non-white peoples of the world.
Right on.
All power to the people.
This is for the brothers and sisters at Kent.
Fall in with Spec 4 Army, retired. I'm taking in 9 Purple Hearts, Distinguished Service Cross, Silver Star, Bronze Star, Army Commendation, and a lot of other shit. This is for my brothers.
We don't want to fight anymore, but if we have to fight again, it'll be to take these steps.
See, I would say that we weren't wrong to want to fight, and we aren't wrong to know now that you have to fight. But, and it's for a pretty simple reason, because what we saw by that point in time, and I think what a lot of people have reckoned with in themselves, is that to not act, to not do anything, or to not do as much as you can do, whatever it is as violent, as criminal, as complicit, as doing everything you can do, and some of it will be right and some of it will be wrong, and you'll have to change and do better.
The next film I made was called In the King of Prussia, and I'm an atheist, but I have always admired Daniel and Philip Berrigan because they were brave, and of what the, because of what they did.
They were priests, right?
They're priests. One is a Jesuit, and one was resigned from the priesthood and is married, has children, and runs a house in the middle of the black district of Baltimore where anybody is welcome to stay or be fed. Or, so they had decided to attack a thermonuclear nose cone at the General Electric plant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. And they did this, and I made a film about it. And Martin Sheen heard about it, and I knew him anyway, but he said, Dee, I want to be in the film. I'll play any part you want me to play. And I said, well, Martin, I'd like you to be the judge. He's the bad guy. And he said, oh, I'd love to do that. I'll be the judge. So Martin is the judge. But not only was the judge, he said, it must cost a lot of money to make that film. I said, well, that's my problem. It does. He said, well, let me give you some. So instead of paying him to act in the film, he sent me a check for $10,000. And that film, the films changed people's lives. That film changed Martin's life. Because Martin has now been arrested 7 or 8 times in demonstrations. And he's now connected with Mitch Snyder and the homeless movement in Washington. And his own children think he's bananas, you know, because he goes out and does it. He's middle age now. He's 48 or 9. He goes out and does all this stuff and gets arrested. And
he hadn't been active until that movie he was in here?
No. So you politicized him?
I've politicized a lot of people.
Hi, Mr. Eckel. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, Commonwealth calls its first witness Richard Moravec, Captain of Security at General Electric. How long have you been at Security at GE?
22 years.
And what building are you assigned to?
Building 9, Reentry Division, King of Prussia.
Directing your attention to September 9th, 1980, do you recall at 6:30 a.m. or thereabouts what, if anything unusual, happened?
Yes, a man dressed as a priest entered the building. A woman accompanied him.
Are either of those two in the courtroom today?
Yes, they are.
The two that are standing, can you identify them?
Father Cabot, Montgomery's sister.
Then what happened, if anything?
Well, Father Cabot grabbed me by my arms and pinned me against the wall when I picked up the phone. Miss Montgomery tried to get the phone off me and held her hand on the receiver so I couldn't make my phone call.
Who were you attempting to call?
My superior, Mr. Bauman.
Okay. Now, would you describe to the jury exactly how you were held?
Well, my desk was here and the phone was here. I picked up the phone with my left hand. Father Cabot had his hands on my upper arms and I was against the wall this way.
And what did this man Montgomery do?
Well, she kept trying to get the phone away from me. She held her hand down on the receiver so the phone call wouldn't go through. She kept saying, don't call, don't call.
Okay. Then describe what you observed after that.
Well, at the time I was being held, 6 other people entered the building. They went into the inner doors in single file.
Did you say anything to these people?
Yes. I told them they were unauthorized not to enter the building, that it was private property.
And in response to what you said to them, did they do anything?
No. They just kept on walking through the doors.
Father Carl Cabot and Ann Montgomery led the way. They went inside and introduced themselves to the security guard who had a little desk. They shook his hand, they introduced themselves, said that they were there for nonviolent, peaceful purposes. Meanwhile, what we were doing was walking around right behind them and through the second door. The guard, I could see him looking at us with some question, but before he had time to react, I think we were all inside, the 6 of us. Carl was right with the guard, and Ann had her hand at the telephone. The guard immediately sensed that something was going on that wasn't the normal opening of the regular day at that plant. And so he went to the telephone, and as he reached for the phone, he made it clear that he was going to, you know, get hold of that phone, and rather than resist him, left the phone alone and turned around and came and followed us inside. So at that point, there were seven of us inside the building. Carl, meanwhile, stayed out and continued to engage conversation with the guard, who then put him in a bear hug.
Okay. Now, at that point, were they doing any singing?
At that point, they stopped and they all joined hands and they started to chant hymns, I guess. I don't know. I wasn't listening. I know it was something. Anyway, at that time, I said, everybody out this way. They all filed out. We went down the passageway toward the rear lobby, and as we were going along the passageway, there were these white steel drums lined up along the right side of the passageway, and they each had the white pamphlets on the steel drums. And, that time, I noted the third person in front of me lunge for a secret tag was on one of these pamphlets and started to rip it in two. At that time, I lunged forward to grab, you know, take it out of his grasp, which I did.
Do you recall who that was?
Yes, it was Philip Berrigan. At that time, I said, that's private property. He said, that's people's property.
Okay. Now, when you observed that section of the building, in what state or condition was it?
There was blood all over the floors, and paperwork, and there was one piece of hardware. It was aluminum, had holes punched in it.
Did you see any of the midsections, if you observed them?
One piece of...
Clarify, midsection is a euphemism for Mark 12A nuclear warhead.
Your Honor, Mr. Sushart is interrupting me.
Well, describe what you mean by this aluminum piece with the holes in it, if you can.
Well, it's shaped like a funnel-shaped piece of aluminum.
What's it used for?
Objection, Your Honor.
I am security only. I have no idea what these products consist of or what they're used for. I am strictly security.
At any time, has anybody instructed you on what we're guarding?
We were supposed to guard General Electric property.
Property? What property? What is it?
I didn't ask what the property was. My job is security.
The General Electric told people like Captain Moravec what they're guarding in plan number 9, what they're protecting. Have you been informed by General Electric concerning the so-called property there?
And these certainly are not questions of philosophy, they're questions of fact. He should know what he's guarding and be able to tell us.
That question was never asked.
It was asked.
No, it wasn't. You may call your next witness, Mr. Eccles.
Mr. Bauman, by whom are you employed?
General Electric.
And how long have you been...
Manager of shop operations.
And how long have you been employed by GE?
20 years.
Okay. I show you Commonwealth Exhibit 58, and I ask you, can you identify that?
Yes, I can.
And what is that?
That is what we call the mid-shield, or shell, rather. It's the aluminum structure.
Okay. And is that what you observed some of the seven or some of the eight striking?
Yes, I did.
Okay, now, if you look at this exhibit, it looks as though there are various indentations, marks. What have you?
Your Honor, we're willing to stipulate all this. I don't know what he's adding to what we've already admitted.
We admit that we've added it.
They're for the benefit of the jury.
Well, is there any way you can throw it so the audience could know?
The audience is not relevant to the audience. It's only relevant to the jury. We're not playing first-run theater here.
It is a public trial, isn't it?
Okay, when you went in there and observed them, exactly what did you observe them doing? And would you describe it for the members of the jury?
Well, as I say, there was this woman beating on the hardware, blood on the floor, at least what I thought was blood, and these people were having a lusty old time smashing the hardware, beating on it with both hands, some with both hands, some with the right hand, some with one hand. I'm not certain that they used their left hands or not.
Okay. And how long was it after that that everything stopped?
Oh, I would say after about 5 seconds, everything was over.
And what items were damaged?
Two structures we call midsections.
Directing your attention to C6.
Do you recognize these sections of these thermonuclear warheads?
I can't answer that.
You are not aware that they contain 335 kilotons?
I do not recognize that.
A thermonuclear device?
No, I do not.
And you've worked for General Electric for how long?
Over 20 years.
20 years.
That's right.
And how long have you worked at plant number 9?
About 13 years.
13 years.
That's right.
And how long has plant number 9 been in production of Mark 12, Mark 12A, or the Mark 500?
10 years.
10 years. And throughout that time, you were not aware that these are thermonuclear...
Would you ask me that question again?
Which question? Can you restate and answer it yourself?
You asked me to identify that as a nuclear warhead.
Yes.
I can't do that.
You think it's being used for kitchenware?
That retorted question was stricken from the record. It is not responsive and not questioning and irrelevant.
You must think it's being used for something.
We are not going to have any speeches here, Reverend. I'm telling you that right now. I'm not going to have this sort of disruption.
Mr. Bowman, from your work at GE or from what you've been told by the company, are you familiar with what is being manufactured at plant number 9?
I can't answer that.
Well, what's your capacity vis-a-vis this non-destructible testing area?
Well, my responsibility is to manufacture the hardware. Okay?
Are you referring to Mark 12A?
That's correct.
And is that the general vocabulary that's used at plant number 9?
That's right.
And are the workers there specifically forbidden to refer to the Mark 12A?
They don't refer to nuclear warheads, and they know nothing about nuclear warheads.
Well, show me one. Do you maybe know where the shells are delivered to?
Objection, Your Honor.
Objection sustained.
Highly irrelevant. We're trying...
It may be a matter of national security. The question will not go answered.
Not a matter of my security. Your Honor, the jury are among the few in the world...
Objection, Your
Honor. ...that will see such weapons before they're used on people. I was wondering... Very few in their whole lives get to see a nuclear weapon like this.
Objection.
Objection sustained. We are not making any speeches about these weapons or whether they are, in fact, weapons.
Is that a joke?
No, it is not a joke. It seems to be a pathetic mistake so far.
Pathetic mistake? You mean... It just occurred to me that you referred in front of a jury to our action of September 10th as, it quotes, pathetic mistake.
And this in the presence of the jury.
I did not. I said from the testimony so far, it appears to be a pathetic mistake.
It seems to me that this was a most prejudicial remark to make in the presence of a jury. I think at this point, you should declare a mistrial.
Are you making a motion? Motion denied. I made no such outburst or any kind of statement whatsoever about this trial.
Objection, Your Honor.
Objection sustained.
I'm talking, Your Honor, about a witness that we intend to bring before the court who is an expert.
Objection, Your Honor.
We will be bringing in expert witnesses, such as Robert Aldridge, to give you information about the kind of harm and the evil that we were trying to avoid. We will be presenting testimony.
Objection, Your Honor.
From an international law expert at Princeton, Richard Falk, which makes clear that the principles of international law are binding in a Pennsylvania courtroom. We're arguing in Pennsylvania the GE King of Prussia, and that the people who operate that plant are bound by international law, just as the German citizens and the people who operated the death camp operations during World War II were bound in principle to follow standards of international law.
So the establishment and the ruling class in this country are very much on the right track from their point of view of suppressing as much of your stuff as possible, because you do politicize and radicalize people.
That's my intention, after all, isn't it? I mean, I don't make these films as an academic exercise.
But radicalize, all you do really is show what
is
really
the truth
is happening.
Is.
What the truth, and truth is reality.
But the truth
is radical.
Yeah. The truth is always radical.
Reality is radical.
Reality is radical is absolutely correct, because if we knew if the American people, I believe enough in America and the American people to feel that if they knew what was really going on, say, in Nicaragua, not this blather that Dan Rather puts out, but, you know, what really is happening there, there'd be a sense of outrage about it. But we've already brainwashed on that subject.
This is why your work is so radical and subversive, because the official version of reality, whether it's the Kennedy assassination, the Vietnam War, Nixon, Nicaragua, is lies. It's distortions. So if you counter that with the truth, you're coming off as a radical, subversive. You're subverting the official account.
I'm very self-destructive. The most useful person to me in all the world is Vincent Canby of the New York Times. He's their chief film critic. He gave Milhouse a review that guaranteed it a hit. It would be a hit in New York. But I attacked him anyway, and it finished my getting a review from the New York Times. But I attacked him on the question of actually El Salvador. And I ended my letter by saying to him, not only am I right and are you wrong, but I challenge you to have the entire staff of the New York Times go over any of my work and find one place where I've tampered with history. Mm. Go find one, and then you can write about it and call me a liar. Mm. And he could not find one. I mean, there are always tricks in film, but there's... there are cuts that are a little faster than they should be, or something else, perhaps, but there's nothing as cooked in my work as was cooked in the work of the United States government during this whole period on any one of the subjects I addressed.
Well, Judge Salas has just finished sentencing. He gave four of the men 3 to 10 years in the penitentiary. They were Bill and Dan and Carl and John. He gave two of the men 1.5 years to 5 in the penitentiary. He gave Molly 2 to 5 in the penitentiary, and he gave Ann 1.5 to 5 in the penitentiary. In addition, he added probation time of 5 years for the shorter prison sentences and 10 years for the longer prison sentences, to run consecutive with the prison sentences. He revoked bail for all and gave credit for time served heretofore. The sentencings are an incredible miscarriage of justice, and they show how dangerous it is to seek peace in America.
And that's the end of our third in the four-part series on Emile D'Antonio. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We'd like to thank our crew who participated in the program, Brian Lynch, Sue Kim, Catherine Galatera. And particularly we're grateful to Lisa Ann Henderson, who did such a great job in editing the whole four-part series on Emile D'Antonio and his documentaries. By the way, if you'd like to see them in their entirety, contact MPI Home Video, 15825 Rob Roy Drive, Oak Forest, Illinois, 60452, or call 1-800-323-0442. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Goodbye.